Ah, Professor Babbage, step in out of the snow. And you too, young man. Is this lad your assistant?
Yes, indeed. This is Wilkes, one of my more promising students. Here, this goose is for you.
Thank you ever so much for your kindness, Professor Babbage. And thanks to you, young man. Here, get yourself some refreshment with this.
No, thank you, but it's not necessary.
It's only a couple of coppers. Please, it's just a token. And I'd feel a lot better for giving it.
Oh, very well. I'm afraid we must be off. Merry Christmas to you.
And to you too, Professor. And to you, young Wilkes.
Well, that's the last one delivered. What say you, Wilkes, to some refreshment?
Oh, yes, definitely, sir.
Merry Christmas.
And to you. Thank you.
Nice to see the snow at Christmas, don't you think, Professor?
It most certainly is. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Bless you, sir. And thank you for your generosity.
You're welcome. Merry Christmas. Wilkes, I think we should seek refuge and refreshment in the nearest hostelry. Tell me, how much damage would be done to a student standing among his fellows were he to be seen in the Bull's Head in the company of a member of staff?
If it transpired that the member of staff was paying the bill, then I believe it would enhance rather than harm his standing. Besides, even though the Bull's Head is a favoured watering hole for students, I expect most of them will have gone home for Christmas by now.
Yes, of course. It is the 23rd. Aren't you going home for Christmas?
No. No. My parents are overseas and they want me to spend Christmas with my Aunt Edith. But, well, let's just say I'd rather not.
Don't get on too well then with Aunt Edith.
No. Nor her family.
Then you shall have Christmas dinner with me.
Oh, sir, I couldn't impose.
I insist. There's no imposition. That's settled, then. In the meantime, let us repair to the Bull's Head for a glass or two of mulled wine.
Christmas time invariably brings back memories of my old maths professor. This was once his study. And when I became a professor, I inherited his rooms. It felt curiously appropriate. Like coming home. It's over 40 years now. No, I must be more precise. He would expect that. Let's see, 1889, 42 years ago. The Michaelmas term was nearing its end when I had my first encounter with the great mathematician and physicist, Professor Albert G. Orrit, H.M. Of course, I had been attending his lectures for months, but this was the first time he actually spoke to me or even noticed my existence.
Better get a move on, Babbage. Eld Orrit doesn't take too kindly to anyone arriving late for his lectures. Here, where are you going?
Lecture room 2.
You really should pay more attention, Babbage. I know you're just a yokel, not fully au fait with the ways of the world, but not knowing even the number of your lecture room. And you aspire to being a mathematician.
But it's always lecture room 2.
Look behind you. At the notice board, you idiot.
Due to renovations to lecture room 2, Professor Orrit's lectures today are transferred to lecture room 5. Damn! Where's room 5?
The far side of the quad and up 2 flights of stairs. Chop, chop, my boy. You know what old Al is like about punctuality.
Drake, aren't you coming?
No. I've got a special tutorial with Redlaw.
What time is it now?
Time you got a watch, Babbage. According to mine, you've got 3 and maybe... just 3. 2:59, 2:58, 2:57, 2:56. Now, who could have put that notice up there? Room 2, I believe.
There is little I can do about how well they function, but I do insist that the brains of those attending my lectures are awake and oxygenated. Let's have some windows open, shall we? Ah, cool, clean, fresh air. Excellent. Now, I will preface this lecture by reminding you again that words are unreliable and cannot communicate truths. All they can do is convey opinions, and even that they do inadequately. The ultimate truths can be found only in mathematics. Now, let us examine the truths of entropy and thermodynamics. Who dares enter the room when a lecture of mine is in progress?
Babbage, sir. Nicholas Babbage.
Well, Nicholas Babbage, what is the reason for this intrusion?
I was misled, misinformed
about... We are all misled and misinformed, Babbage, but some more seriously than others. And it appears I myself have been misled into believing the most serious cases were confined to the arts department. Babbage, I was just about to start my lecture on the mathematics of entropy and the laws of thermodynamics when I was rudely interrupted by your late arrival. Do you know what entropy is?
Yes, sir. I believe I do.
Would you care to share this with us?
It is the amount of disorder in a system or a process. And in all processes, entropy increases.
And?
The concept was introduced in 1865 by Rudolf Clausius as part of his work on the first and second laws of thermodynamics. With Emile Clapeyron, he deduced the Clausius-Clapeyron relation as a way of characterizing the phase transition between two states of matter, such as liquid or solid. In a paper published in 1867...
Thank you, Mr. Babbage. That was most illuminating, coming from someone as misinformed as your good self. Do you possess a watch?
No, sir.
See that you get one and don't be late again. Now, with your permission, we will continue. F equals G by M1 by M2... over R squared. Newton's law of universal gravitation, a thing of beauty. An equation with the elegance of a Bach fugue and the majesty of the Hallelujah chorus. M1 and M2 are the masses of two objects. R is the distance between them, and G is... Can anyone tell me what G is? Yes, Babbage, I'm sure you know. Anyone other than Babbage? No? No one? I suppose you had better enlighten us, Babbage.
G is the gravitational constant, sir.
Yes, that is indeed what G is.
So, Professor... What is this highly secretive research of yours all about?
If I were to divulge that to you, Sawyer, it would no longer be highly secretive, now would it?
You can trust me. I'm your doctor.
Though we might never admit it, those of us who labour in the sciences, mathematicians, physicists, chemists and the like, hunger for recognition and adulation with the same ferocity as any who dabble in the arts.
Ah.
Consequently... Though we might confer and collaborate with one another to an extent, we can be fiercely competitive and secretive about our research if we think we are on to something big.
Mm.
This I can confide in you, as it is an ailment of mine, and therefore it is covered by your Hippocratic oath.
The condition of your heart and your blood pressure are the ailments that should concern you. You must slow down. Consider your age. Can't you find a student to assist with your research? Do some of the donkey work, take some of the pressure off?
I can think of nothing more likely to put me under greater pressure and give me palpitations than engaging one of my students as an assistant. Perhaps you would understand a little better if I were to tell you something of the nature of my research and of my students.
I'm all ears.
You certainly caught old Orrit on the hop today, Nicholas. I don't believe I've ever seen a student stand up to him before. Good show.
Thank you, Barnes. I didn't set out to tackle him. It was just...
Ah! Babbage and Barnes. A brace of bumpkins in their rooms.
Drake, you might have had the good manners to knock.
Did you hear that, chaps? The yokel is not only a whiz in mathematics, but also an authority on manners and proper behaviour.
And a natty dresser, too. I say, Drake, take a look in this wardrobe.
Good Lord, Babbage. Is this what passes for fashion up north in Rochdale or Rotherham or wherever it is you come from?
Give me those! I'm from Barnstable, and it's in the south, in Devon.
Who are by gum?
I think I smell cow dung.
No, I think the country boy shat himself.
Well, did they get a bit of a shock today?
That wasn't funny.
Not funny, Babbage. We all thought it was hilarious, didn't we, chaps?
Absolutely hilarious.
And in fairness to you, Babbage, you acquitted yourself admirably. You don't often see old Orrit stopped in his tracks. We are here to salute you as a jolly good sport, aren't we, chaps?
Absolutely.
And just because you're here on scholarship, paid for by benevolent wealthy families like, well, like ours, doesn't mean we think any less of you, does it, lads?
Of course not.
In fact, the second reason we've come to visit you this evening is to invite you to join our soccer team. And you too, Barnes. The Blues, Babbage and Barnes. You could be our goalkeeper, Babbage. And you, Barnes, could be our new centre-forward.
He'll have to lose these spectacles.
Give him here. OK, so I'll take a throw in to you, Barnes, and you head it past Babbage for a goal, right?
I can't see without my spectacles.
Drake, give him back his spectacles.
Are you giving me an order, Babbage?
Call it what you like. Now give Barnes back his spectacles.
Or what?
This!
Ooh, good Lord! What a punch! He's out cold.
Drake? Wake up, Drake!
What happened?
He hit you with a real haymaker.
Pretty appropriate, wouldn't you say? A haymaker from a country bumpkin.
Who just happens to be the junior lightweight boxing champion of Devon and Cornwall for the last 2 years.
I think my nose is broken.
Consider yourself lucky. Now get out and don't bother Ernest or me again.
One of my students, quite by chance, made reference today to an old colleague of mine, Rudolf Clausius. He was professor of mathematics for many years at Bonn.
Mm-hmm.
And the student also referred to Rudolf's work on thermodynamics, which first set me on my quest for the grand equation.
Ha ha! Is this what your top secret research is all about? The grand equation?
Yes. And I believe another colleague, Professor Planck at Berlin, is conducting similar research on thermodynamics and atomic structure. Though, of course, he denies it.
Excuse a country doctor's ignorance. What is this grand equation?
That's the mystery. We don't know for sure. It's a bit like El Dorado, and there are those who believe that, like El Dorado, it is just a fable.
But that's not what you believe, is it?
Well, let's say it's worth searching for, because even if it does turn out to be a myth, the quest itself will be a fascinating and illuminating one.
But how will you know it if you find it?
It will be an equation of stunning simplicity and awesome power, a key to unlock all the wonders of the universe.
Good heavens. Look, I had a vision of scientists trying to find the keys to lots of small doors set in a great door, and as each one is opened, a little more light gets through. But for every door that's opened, they also discover several more doors they didn't realize were there. But I never imagined there was a lock on the great door itself, let alone a key.
Oh, there is certainly a lock, and if there is a lock, there must be a key. Of course, it may never be found.
Do you know, I don't believe I would want all the wonders of the universe explained. So I'm not sure I wish you success in your research. A world without wonder would be a dreary place.
And if by chance you found yourself holding that very key, do you expect me to believe you would not open the door?
I'm surprised at you, a mathematician, asking foolish, hypothetical questions.
Touché, Doctor. I think it's time for a little of the music of Bach. I doubt that will ever lose its wonder. Ready?
Ready.
One, two, three. One, two, three. Three.
The end of term and the following spring term passed quietly enough. Tarquin Millington Drake never bothered me again. In fact, he and one of his henchmen dropped out of college and neither returned for the spring term. I wasn't too displeased. Professor Orrit continued doing his research and preaching passionately to his students on the transcendence of mathematics.
The philosophical dichotomy between form and substance is resolved in mathematics. Melody, harmony, and rhythm in music, balance, perspective, and proportion in art, the very notion of beauty itself, are all fundamentally aspects of numerical relationships. There is an absolute transcendent reality, and it is pure mathematics. Philosophers have abandoned the search for truth. They know the sole remaining task for philosophy is the analysis of language. This is no more than vacuous sophistry. If God ever spoke to us, he would sing in calculus.
Then, on the 23rd of May, 1890...
Let us take the three states of matter, solid, liquid, and gas. Numbers are solid. They are precise, concrete, and enduring. Words are liquid. They are fluid and take the shape of the containers into which they are poured. Then there are words and combinations of words which are gaseous, just hot air. Ah, Mr. Babbage, as I recall, you have your arm raised, I see. Are you engaging in some class of exercise, or do you have some hot air you wish to release?
Sir, these states are not fixed. Doesn't matter assume a solid, liquid, or gaseous state depending on temperature and pressure? Solids can be melted, liquids frozen, and gases liquefied.
Young man, since you are astute enough to make this profound observation, you must surely be aware that I am attempting to elucidate a complex metaphysical proposition by the use of a metaphor. And a metaphor, by definition, is not meant to be taken literally. Were I to enter this room and announce that it was raining cats and dogs outside, only an idiot would rush to the window in anticipation of seeing tabbies and cocker spaniels falling from the sky. The point you make, nonetheless, does serve to further confirm my contention that words are slippery and unreliable. That will be all for today. Those of you who haven't already left your answers to the geometry question, please do so before you leave. Solids melt, liquids freeze, and gases...
Oh, I'm sorry, Professor Orrit. I was sure this room was for English Lit at 3:30.
Pardon me, you're absolutely right. It's I who should apologize to you, Mr. Brodie, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
The room is yours. I've stayed a little longer than I should. Forgive me.
Ach, there's no need to apologize. But I'm a wee bit surprised. I was full sure it was I who made the mistake, because I've heard you're always so precise. Are you feeling all right, Professor?
I'm fine, thank you. Tell me, what is the subject of your lecture today?
Medievalism and the Romantic Poets.
Fascinating.
I'm a great lover of the Romantic Poets, Professor. How about you?
I know only a little of their work. I find a little goes a long way.
And a little more will go a lot further, I assure you, Professor. If only you were willing to surrender to its magic, to be seduced and captivated by its charm. I'll drop some books into you.
That's very kind of you, but I'm rather busy with my research right now, and I doubt I would get the time to read them. But thank you again for your kind offer.
Oh, you're welcome, I'm sure. Tell me, what class of thing are you researching then?
I see your students await you. I best go and let you get on with your lecture. Goodbye.
Yes. Goodbye, Professor.
Simple question in geometry and still not a single correct answer. What time is it? Almost 5 minutes past 11. Let's see, when have I done? I'll just do a couple more. I don't believe it. 23 degrees 5 minutes. The correct answer at last. Let me see whose paper this is. I might have known. Nicholas Babbage. Just a minute. 23 degrees 5 minutes. It's 5 minutes past the 23rd hour. And today is the 23rd of May. The 23rd of the 5th. Extraordinary. What is the probability of a confluence like that, I wonder? I am all too aware that this is your last lecture before the summer break. That means the holiday does not commence till after this lecture. Before and after. Very simple concepts. However, on the evidence of the inane scribbling most of you submitted as answers to a straightforward geometry question, your brains, or what passes for brains, have departed and are already on vacation. Now, though it's not on your course for this term, I am going to tell you something about probability theory. Probability theory is the mathematical study of phenomena characterized by randomness or uncertainty, like the toss of a coin or dice, the turn of a playing card, or the spin of a roulette wheel, or finding the correct answer among these papers of yours. I have calculated the probability, and I would be as likely to get as many correct answers from an equivalent number of chimpanzees as I did from this class. Mr. Darwin didn't need to go all the way to the Galapagos Islands to establish our collective ancestry. He would have found ample evidence of it right here. Babbage, would you be so kind as to come to my office this afternoon? Say, 23 minutes after 5?
Yes, sir. 23 minutes past 5.
Come in. Ah, Babbage. Let me see. Ah, yes. Pretty good timing for someone with no watch. Would I be correct in believing you are still without a chronometer?
Yes, sir. I did get one for Christmas last, but it's at the watchmaker's. The spring or something.
Mm-hmm. You're here by dint of some bursary or endowment, I understand.
Yes, sir.
Well, my boy, there's no shame in that. On the contrary, you can take pride in the fact. Indeed, my own education was paid for by a benevolent relative. You know you are the one clever chimpanzee, don't you?
Sir?
You alone got the correct answer. 23 degrees, 5 minutes. And this I discovered at 23:05 last night on the 23rd day of the 5th month.
My God, sir. What is the probability of that?
Like the number of stars in the heavens, incalculable. I am skeptical about messages from other dimensions, but this has all the hallmarks of a revelation, an epiphany. The significance, however, is not immediately obvious and requires further investigation.
So it would seem.
Well, my doctor has advised me to take on an assistant to do what he referred to as the donkey work. How are you with donkeys, Babbage?
Oh, I'm from a farming background, sir, so they shouldn't be a problem.
Good. The summer holidays are upon us, and if you find yourself with time on your hands over the next few months, you might give some thought to this improbable confluence of date, time, and angle, and the numbers 23 and 5, or 2, 3, and 5, and see if you can discover any special significance these numbers might have. I suspect they are the key to something very profound. Do you follow?
I think so, sir.
When we return in the autumn, you will be my assistant, so your fees will be waived. You will receive a modest contribution to your upkeep, and you will need this, just until your own comes back from the watchmaker.
Sir, that is most generous of you.
You'll earn it. And remember, you may not communicate anything of this research to a living soul. I take it I need never mention this again.
Never.
Good.
What is it we're after, sir?
The Holy Grail, Babbage. The Holy Grail.
I spend most of the summer poring over books and making calculations in libraries, in bed at night, and in all sorts of improbable places. When I returned in the autumn, I went straight to Professor Orrit's room.
Well, what have you got?
I don't have much, I'm afraid.
Of course, 2, 3, and 5 are the first three prime numbers.
After 0 and 1, they are also the next three numbers in the Fibonacci sequence.
So the next numbers would be 8, 13, and 21. Where does that get us, I wonder?
I don't know, sir. It would greatly help if I had some idea as to where we are trying to get.
Do you know what the grand equation is?
The equation that's supposed to be at the heart of everything? Do you believe there is such an equation?
I believe it's worth looking for, if only for what the search itself might reveal. Therefore, I have resolved to retire from lecturing to concentrate fully on doing just that.
And you believe 23 and 5 are part of it?
Not exactly. I think this is a riddle that must be solved, like a century one must pass before going on to the next phase of the quest. But I believe it will take me very close to my objective. Like landing on square 28 in Snakes and Ladders.
What's in square 28?
The bottom rung of the longest ladder on the board. The one that takes you all the way up to square 84.
Good afternoon, Professor Orrit. I didn't think you were a soccer fan.
I'm not, Mr. Hamilton, but I was taking a stroll when I saw the game in progress. I realized there were 22 players and a referee chasing a bag of wind around a field. An absurd activity, of course, but I thought it might shed some light on a project I'm working on right now.
And has it done?
Not so far. Tell me, how is our team doing?
We're 5-0 down, and there's 23 minutes left to play.
We're doing as well as that, eh?
Look out, Professor! Professor, are you all right? Professor? Here, let me help you up.
What happened?
You just made a spectacular header.
I did?
Well, our none-too-accurate winger attempted a cross which struck you in the head and put you on the seat of your pants.
I see.
Not too well, I imagine. Your spectacles got broken.
On the contrary, I can see better than ever.
Are you sure you're all right?
I'm fine. Who kicked that ball?
I did, sir. I'm sorry, sir.
No need to apologize, my boy. It was an excellent shot.
I'll get one of the boys to accompany you back to your room.
Thank you, but there's no need. I never felt better. What you could do is send someone to find Nicholas Babbage and bring him to me right away, if you please. Come in, come in. Ah, Babbage. I think I might have cracked it. Here, come and take a look at this.
Do you mean the globe, sir?
Yes, yes, the globe. What do you notice about it?
Well, it's round.
Yes, like a football. And anything else?
It revolves on its axis?
Yes, and what else? There's something else.
Its axis is tilted.
Exactly, Babbage. Its axis is tilted. I've broken my good reading spectacles, so I want you to get down the book on geography for me. It should be just over there. Yes. Next shelf up. No, a little to your left. Yes, about there. Can you see it?
Yes, I've got it.
Good, excellent. Now, look up Earth's axis, angle of tilt in the index. Have you got it?
Just a second. Yes, it's here. I have it.
Well, what does it say?
The Earth's axial tilt varies over time between 22 and 24 degrees from the vertical, the mean average being about 23 degrees, 5 minutes.
23 degrees, 5 minutes. Mr. Babbage, do you know what this means?
What, sir?
It means we've just landed on square 28. Let's take the ladder up to square 84, shall we?
I thought we'd done for old Orrit the other day. Uh-huh. He was actually watching a soccer match when he was clocked on the head by a football. And the old guy went down like an empty sack. I thought he was a goner. Then up he hops, fresh as a daisy, and he's off like a hare with a grin on him like a Cheshire cat.
For a games coach, you've quite a fondness for the similes, have you not, Mr. Hamilton?
I beg your pardon, a fondness for the what?
The similes. Oh, it doesn't matter. You know, I spoke to Professor Orrit just once last term. I thought he was away with the fairies.
I imagine you would probably be fairly familiar with them yourself, Mr. Brodie.
Oh, come now, Mr. Hamilton. We must not split our infinitives. It betrays a lack of refinement.
And how are things in the chemistry department, Mr. Wilberforce?
Bubbling along nicely, Mr. Redlaw, thank you. And in geography?
Oh, fine, fine, thank you. I believe you bumped into old Orrit yesterday.
I did indeed. You know he's not lecturing anymore, devoting all his time to his research. But nobody knows for sure what it is he's researching.
Including Orrit.
I heard it has something to do with some formula or equation that explains everything.
Oh, yes, the grand equation.
Could there be such a thing?
Of course not. It's a mathematical myth.
It seems after the knock on the head, he thought the football had produced a similar effect to Newton's apple and was wittering on about the Earth's angle of tilt as if he had discovered gravity.
There's nothing new about the Earth's angle of tilt. Since it's not a constant, the average is taken. And that's an angle of a little over 23 degrees. And it has been known a long time.
What's the significance of this angle of tilt, then?
Well, it's responsible for the seasons and the cyclical nature of life on Earth.
What if there was no tilt? Or if you could compensate for it? What effect would that have?
The question's academic. It can't be done.
Where can one ask academic questions if not here? Humour me, Mr. Redlaw. What if it could be done?
Yes, Mr. Redlaw, please, humour us. We are all fascinated.
Professor Orrit, please forgive me. I didn't realise you'd come in.
Please continue. I would like to hear your answer.
Well, I don't really know. The whole cycle of life and death would change in ways I can only imagine. There would be no seasons. So I suppose there will be no cycle, which raises all kinds of questions.
Indeed. And would not the effects of eliminating this tilt be most noticeable at the poles?
I expect it would. If you could stand the cold, you might live for centuries. But speculation is purely fanciful. Hypothetical questions like these are for the writers of science fiction, not real scientists.
Mr. Redlaw, you are absolutely correct. Thank you, all the same, for your observations. Most interesting.
The professor's need for my assistance with his research came to an abrupt halt, and I saw little of him during the following weeks. Often I was asked,
What in the devil is old Orrit up to? And I could answer honestly, I have no idea. He hadn't given me any clue how the angle of the Earth's tilt was connected with his quest for the grand equation, or even whether it was connected at all. He spent hours in the library, poring over geography books, maps, books on polar expeditions and the like. Late into the night, candles burned in his room. He was seen tottering across the quad late one evening in a most extraordinary pair of boots that caused him to walk at a peculiar angle, and he used a stick for support. Then, on the morning of December the 23rd, he asked to see me in his room. When I got there, he was feeding the birds on his window ledge.
Winter is tough for these little ones, is it not?
It is. Sir, I see you're packing away all your belongings. Are you leaving?
Not immediately, but soon enough. Dr. Sawyer calculates my chances of seeing out the spring term are 5-1 and 50-1 against my surviving till next Christmas.
The doctor knows little of probability theory, then.
But a lot about heart conditions and blood pressure. Nonetheless, I intend proving him wrong.
I'm sure you will, sir.
I've kept you in the dark for a while now, which must seem unreasonable to you. Well, I'm afraid I must keep you in the dark a little while longer. But when the time is right, I will reveal all to you. However, the reason I've asked you here is for your assistance in another matter.
I am at your service.
Thank you. As I expect you're aware, most of the poorer households in town are without ovens. And if they do somehow acquire a goose for Christmas dinner, the baker cooks it for them in his. Tomorrow we must collect the geese I have left the bakers for cooking and deliver them to some families in the town. It will take several hours.
This is a kind and a benevolent thing you are doing, Professor. And I would be only too pleased to be of assistance.
Thank you, but please, not a word to anyone.
Not one word. How many geese must we deliver?
This year, 28.
Ah, yes. The square at the foot of the ladder.
Indeed. And also the sum of 23 and 5.
Through the bitter cold of January and February, the professor spent hours and hours outdoors, dressed in various types of clothing. It was rumoured that among the many curious visitors that came to see him were a couple of Eskimos who brought clothing made of seal skin. The days grew longer and warmer, thanks to that tilt, and the professor's disposition grew warmer and more optimistic. He was missing for most of April, and at the beginning of May, the last of his belongings were collected and taken away. Early on the morning of the 23rd of May, 1891, I spoke with Professor Orrit for the very last time.
Come in, come in. Ah, Nicholas Babbage, is that not a beautiful morning?
It certainly is, sir.
A propitious morning to embark on a great adventure, wouldn't you agree?
What great adventure would that be, sir?
Ah, I shall explain. Sit down, sit down. There are still a couple of chairs left. Would you care to join me in a glass of port?
Oh, I don't mind if I do, sir.
Excellent. A little early in the day, perhaps, but exceptional circumstances, eh? Your good health.
Cheers.
I apologize for asking you here at this ungodly hour, but I had resolved to set off first thing this morning, the morning of this auspicious day, the first anniversary of the revelation, the epiphany. I wanted to leave quietly while people were asleep, but I wanted to see you before I left.
So it's true you are leaving us, then?
I am off to spend some time living among the Lapps inside the Arctic Circle. I'll work my way gradually towards the North Pole as I acclimatize myself to the weather conditions.
I don't understand. Why?
Because I'm dying. But I believe I might just have been shown a way to cheat death and prolong my life long enough to continue with my quest for the grand equation. I have explained all in this letter and these diaries, which I leave to you along with the globe. Ah,
I hear my carriage has arrived. I must be off. Would you mind taking that case for me? Thank you. Nicholas Babbage, you'll make a fine mathematician one day. Oh, which reminds me, all your course and tuition fees are paid for till you graduate. Goodbye. And one more thing. Please see that the birds are fed, won't you?
I will. And thank you for all your kindness.
Goodbye, Nicholas.
Goodbye, Professor.
I watched the carriage for a long time, till it was just a speck on the landscape. Then it disappeared. I stood gazing at the horizon till the quad became alive with students and lecturers scurrying to and fro. The hustle and bustle sent me to the sanctuary of my room, where I opened and read Orrit's letter to me.
Dear Nicholas Babbage, I entrust to you these diaries in the hope that they may prove to be enlightening. Of course, they may prove to be the mere musings of a mad mathematician. Please wait a few days after I've gone before reading them, and at least a month before revealing their content to others, should you care to do so. When I realized the magic figure 23 degrees 5 minutes was responsible for the circle of life and death on Earth, I knew it was not a key to the grand equation, but a key as to how I could continue with my search for it. I determined that by living at a compensatory angle as near to the pole as possible, I would significantly extend my lifespan. I had a house built at an angle of 23 degrees 5 minutes to the vertical, and boots made which ensured I would maintain the same angle while outside. The Earth revolves more slowly at the pole than at the equator, and a day lasts 3 months, as does a night. Thus, I would have not only more time, but the blissful solitude in which to carry on my research. The mathematics to support these contentions you can find in the diaries of late 90 and early 91. If you are a diligent student and apply yourself to your studies, you'll make a fine mathematician one day. I wish you well. Albert G. Orrit, H.M.
Although I greatly missed old Orrit, I was a diligent student, and I did apply myself to my studies. And 5 years later, in 1896, I returned to college, this time as a lecturer.
I've got two tickets for the Oscar Wilde play for tomorrow night. Would you care to join me?
The importance of being earnest. Oh, I'd love to. I'm a bit of a Wilde fan, I must declare.
Ah, Mr. Babbage. You're the new Mads lecturer, I believe.
I am, yes.
You're very welcome.
You're very kind. Thank you.
Pleasure. Were you not an assistant of Professor Orrit's for a time?
Yes, for a short time.
He was one contrary man, was Professor Orrit.
Have you heard anything from the old blighter?
Not a thing.
Did he really go to live at the North Pole?
Yes, I believe he did.
Surely there's no way he could survive the conditions there.
Well, he wouldn't have had a problem with insulation. He had a hide as tough as a rhinoceros.
I wonder, did he ever find that equation he was after?
The grand equation, wasn't it?
Yes, that was it.
Yes.
There were reports of strange sightings by explorers on polar expeditions.
Yes.
And I did hear a rumour that must have originated with one of them. Apparently, Orrit did discover some powerful formula or equation or whatever, but the implications of it were so awesome and the damage it could do the world so devastating that he decided mankind would best be kept in ignorance of it and that he should keep the secret to himself.
I heard he was eaten by a polar bear. Or was it the other way around?
Some days you eat the bear, but some days the bear eats you.
Very good.
Years went by. Eventually, I became professor of mathematics and took over Orrit's old rooms. The professor's fate became a matter of diminishing concern among his colleagues. Gradually, their interest died away. And eventually, so did they. The next generation of mathematical scholars rarely made mention of him. But among those whose mission it was to brave the ice fields of the Arctic, he acquired the status of legend. Then, in January of 1931, I read this notice in a scientific journal. Umberto Mobile is planning another visit to the North Pole by airship. Mr. Mobile designed and piloted the airship Norge, from which Amundsen made the first undisputed sighting of the pole on May the 12th, 1926. Mobile repeated the flight 2 years later in the airship Italia. He is now planning a flight for this coming May in a larger ship and would welcome inquiries from scientists who might wish to join him. It took a little persuasion, but I managed to convince Mr. Mobile that he needed a mathematician in his party of scientists. As the airship came into land, I was sure I saw something following us. What with the glasses and the swirling snow, it was difficult to make out anything clearly. We landed and all disembarked, eager for the extraordinary experience of setting foot on the North Pole. Again, I thought I saw something moving through the snow, and in following it became separated from the others. Suddenly, the snow cleared, and there stood a rotund man in black boots and a red suit trimmed with white fur. He had a flowing white beard, rosy cheeks, and a most cheerful expression. I couldn't make out the features too clearly, so I took off the protective eyeglasses, and standing before me was Professor Orrit. He was a little plumper than I remembered him, but he hadn't aged at all. In fact, he looked a little younger than he did the last time I saw him. He saw my surprise and began to laugh heartily. Just then, I heard the others calling me, and I called back to reassure them. Two of them came into view, and Orrit turned and disappeared in the swirling snow, his ho, ho, ho ringing in my ears. When I recounted what I had seen, the other members of the expedition were convinced that because I had removed my protective eyeglasses, I was suffering from snow blindness and hallucinating. Though I don't believe it, this may have explained what I imagined I saw, but did my ears deceive me as well? Did I also just imagine I heard that ho, ho, ho echoing across the frozen waste? I thought better of arguing with them and let it go.
Come in. Ah, Wilkes. Come to lend me a hand, I hope.
Yes, sir. You asked me to come to your study at 2 o'clock to help you with some ritual, I think you called it.
And it is now 2 o'clock exactly. Professor Orrit would have been pleased.
I don't know a professor of that name, sir.
No, I don't suppose you would.
He was my predecessor, and this was his study more than 40 years ago. It was he who began this custom, this ritual, way back then, and I am simply carrying on the tradition in his honour.
And what is it, sir?
There are 28 geese we must collect from the bakers and distribute among the more needy households in town. I would appreciate your assistance in this, and afterwards you might care to join me in partaking of some refreshment.
I would be delighted to help.
Excellent. You'd better take a hat and scarf from the hall stand. It's snowing pretty heavily out there. Right then. Off we go.